Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to The Love Code. Thank you for joining me for another opportunity to really be inspired, uplifted, transformed. This program really is for the purpose of allowing us to connect with our true self, with our souls, understanding our connection in the web of life, how important it is to be part of nature, and to be open to the healing that we receive from nature and choose those places that we access within ourselves that open us to such a profound power of healing and transformation. For those who may be listening for the very first time, welcome. I invite you to go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and like me there because I get to post all of the shows. The second show I do on Progressive Radio Network every week on Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time is called What Women Must Know, hence the name of my Facebook page. And you can also go over to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, and get onto my newsletter there because that's another place where I can send out and post to you all of these shows that I do every week. They're fantastic shows because I have such inspiring guests that it really keeps us uplifted. We keep learning, growing, healing, transforming. And isn't that the name of the game? So hope you'll be joining me over on my Facebook page, What Women Must Know, or my website, Dr. Cheryl Selman. And today we have a really special guest and a wonderful conversation. We're going to be talking to an ecologist. We're talking and exploring an ecologist's journey to make peace with the Anthropocene with Alejandro Fried, who is a beautiful writer, ecologist, and he's passionate about nature and indigenous cultures and reconnecting. So if you don't know what the Anthropocene is, you're going to learn about it very shortly, and we have a really wonderful conversation in store for you. So let me begin by introducing Alejandro's biography. So Alejandro Fried is a PhD who has over two decades inhabited the worlds of science, modern indigenous cultures, and climate activism. An ecologist for First Nations of British Columbia's Central Coast, an adjunct assistant professor in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria, Alejandro works collaboratively with First Nations on the integration of traditional knowledge and Western science to advance conservation and revitalize Indigenous control of their resources. His research experience has spanned conflicts between industrial development and terrestrial wildlife, the plight of endangered species, and the effects of overfishing on marine predators. Author of A World for My Daughter, he lives on Bowen Island in British Columbia, and his latest book is Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Alejandro to the show today. Hello, Alejandro.
Hello, I'm very glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you all the way from Bowen Island. I don't know where Bowen Island is. Where is Bowen Island?
It's just outside Vancouver in British Columbia. So it's a small island, but it's not too isolated from the bigger city of Vancouver. It's a very beautiful place to live.
I was going to say it must be just spectacular to be there. I've been to Victoria Island, and I've been to Vancouver, which is by no means representative of British Columbia, but I know it's a beautiful part of the world. I actually did a trip, a cruise to the inside along the Inside Passage, so it's like getting a flavor for the indigenous cultures there in that part of Canada and part of Alaska, which is just so special, really. It's just so special. It's an amazing trip. So, Alejandro, your story is really interesting, and I'd like us to start our conversation today by sharing a bit of your personal journey and the process and the experiences that got you to where you are now.
Yeah, so I'm going to take a little of the approach that Indigenous people use in introducing themselves, which is by giving a very brief history of their broader lineage. And so I am Jewish, which means that my ancestors left the Middle East sometime centuries ago and scattered over Eastern Europe for where they were for perhaps a few centuries. And then just before the Holocaust, my grandparents left Eastern Europe and moved to Mexico City, where they could have a safe haven from everything that was happening in their countries of origin. And my parents were born there. I was born in Mexico City. And then we immigrated to Canada. I had finished high school in Mexico City, and once in Canada, I completely became enthralled by the beauty of the place, particularly British Columbia, where the mountains meet the Pacific Ocean. And it was just very extraordinary paradise in terms of rainforests and glaciated peaks and very, you know, vibrant coasts. But what's interesting is in my earlier years, this would be my late teens, my early 20s, I was experiencing the place as a wilderness, as this amazing place where, you know, I could be free and, you know, and it was just kind of like this open land. But then gradually I began to realize that this was actually the long-term home of sophisticated cultures for many thousands of years. I mean, the indigenous people of this place had very large populations on that coast. So, you know, I at that time I was already engaged in studying ecology. I went to university and got advanced degrees. But as my awareness of the history of indigenous peoples in British Columbia began to take hold of me, I realized that there was a big role to integrate what I was learning as an ecologist with the broader human history of British Columbia. And, you know, one thing led to another and eventually ended up in my current job, which I'm on my seventh year of having, which is working with four Indigenous nations who are collaborating in the integration of science and Indigenous knowledge to advance marine conservation and fishery management in their territories. So I get to, I think of myself as living at the interface of ecology and social justice, which is a very exciting place to be.
So the Indigenous communities actually hired you. You're not involved with the government. It's not a government program. It's actually initiated by the communities themselves.
That's right. I'm the full-time and direct employee of the Kitisu Heihei's Nation, the Heiltsuk, the Nulhok, and the Wikinu. And they got together about, it's about 12 years now, and formally started collaborating in what's called the Central Coast Indigenous Resource Alliance, which is where I work full-time.
So what is the focus and purpose of your position there? What is the goal that you have in your work?
So the goal is for the Indigenous people that I work with to be able to proactively decide what happens in their territories in terms of protecting the many species that are inherent to their culture, not only as traditional foods, but also in broader symbolic ways. They're a very adaptive set of people, so they see science as an important tool to complement their traditional knowledge. So when they hired me, they explicitly wanted me to integrate their traditional knowledge, work with them collaboratively to do so, but also bring scientific tools so that we can discuss, you know, with federal scientists, with policymakers, the concerns that they have with what is not going so well in terms of conservation in their territories, and be able to proactively change policy. And we've had some success stories already.
You know, for those listening who may not know much about the Indigenous people of British Columbia, you know, and I've had people on my show as guests who've talked about Native American cultures. I've had guests on my show who have worked with Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal elders. But maybe you can share a little bit of the culture of those Indigenous people of British Columbia and what happened to them with colonization as well.
Yes, so it's a really long and fascinating story. And when I say long, I mean at least 14,000 years. And that number is specific to an archaeological site that's in the territories of the people I work with. That it formally dates a settlement that's 14,000 years old. There's other sites that archaeological evidence show they were continuously occupied for 7,000 years. And what's fascinating to me is that we're not talking about small numbers of people. We're talking about very high densities of people with very sophisticated technologies for fishing, living sustainably over those long periods of time. Now, this was still going on when Europeans first arrived. And in fact, the estimate for coastal British Columbia and adjacent areas, so this would include, Washington, Oregon, and up to Southeast Alaska, but this is just the coastal fringe. There was somewhere between 100 and 200,000 people living along that coast. Now, granted, it's a lot less than the millions that we have now, but when you have that many people just along the coast living exclusively of local resources, there's the potential to do some serious damage. But that damage was not happening because they were managing themselves through social institutions, through traditional laws to not deplete resources. So all of this was going on, and then Europeans arrive. And it's just utter chaos when that happens in terms of, there's violence, there's dispossession, there's epidemics, there's, the church banned their religious practices, not only the church, but the church combined with government, the governments of the time. So it's a real disruption of culture, and perhaps one of the most poignant parts of that disruption of culture is the period between approximately the 1870s or so and well into the beginning, into the beginning of the 1980s. There was the residential school system in which Indigenous children were taken away from their families. The parents would go to jail if they didn't let their children go, and they would take them away to basically assimilate them. And it's just a horrible history that is not unlike, what can formally become a genocide. Now, fortunately, things have started to become much, much better. The last residential school was closed in the early 80s. There's a resurgence of political influence, of revitalizing of culture that's happening in Indigenous communities. And that is, the people I work with embody that resurgence. So we are really in the upswing of something that was a terrible history for a long time, but something that I see now as extremely positive in terms of recovering a lot of that old wisdom, that goes back for thousands of years, and applying it in a modern context that's very open to other tools such as science, and that's inclusive of non-Indigenous people, but nonetheless has that foundation, that cultural ethos that's fundamental to their culture.
That's such good news to hear, because I don't know if many Americans realize that Canadians were as brutal, I would use that word, I think it's probably accurate, to Indigenous cultures as they were to Native American cultures, as Australians were to Aboriginal people, in the attempt to, they took the kids away in all those cultures. They took the kids away, and they tried to, as you said, take them to schools and forbidden them to use their language and to really disconnect from their identity, it's a horrible practice of destroying the souls of people, and to hear that there's a resurgence and that these indigenous communities have a resilience and that they are able to maintain that knowledge that they've had for thousands and thousands of years is really heartening, I have to say.
Yeah, it is heartening. And the word resilience, which you used, is really key. I mean, they took all these shocks, but they're bouncing back. And a lot of it is thanks to, individuals who were able to escape a residential school because their parents, hid them in the bush or were in just more remote situations where the authorities couldn't, go and find them. But also, even through the residential school, there was a real determination to keep part of the culture going. And the term people from the communities use is that it's not like their culture and their practices were lost. They were muted for a period of time. They were put to sleep for a period of time. Mm-hmm. But this is the time of that awakening in which they're, recovering them in our current modern context.
That's great. That's really good news to hear that's happening. So, first of all, I want to congratulate you on your latest book, Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. It's a great book, a great read. You're a great writer, Alejandro, and you weave a great tale. It's very engaging, so congratulations on that. I wish you all the best. Let's start by defining Anthropocene, because it's in your subtitle. I don't know how many people really understand what that is all about. So why don't we just dive into the Anthropocene right now?
Yeah, no, it's a very important term. And so the way I use it in the book is strictly from the scientific context. And that refers to the end of the previous geologic epoch, which is the Holocene, and the beginning of the next one that we are entering, and that's the Anthropocene. So by a geologic epoch, I mean something that geologists can identify in terms of the general characteristics of the stratigraphy of the Earth, the layers, the different layers of sediments and rocks and soils that are characterize a long period of time on Earth, and then that is changes in some fundamental way that's different enough from its previous condition to become a new epoch. So that was a little bit abstract, but like, for example, to turn it less abstract, so the Holocene is the period after the glaciations, which ended about 12,000 years ago. And so the glaciers retreated, and in the retreat of the glaciers, all sorts of characteristics of soils and earth shapes changed. And also our climate became a lot more benign at the time. It went from, the really cold conditions that had all these glaciers covering the continents to a much more benign climate. And that's what allowed more modern civilization to evolve. That's where, what made agriculture possible. Had we stayed in the ice age, we probably wouldn't have developed the human cultures that we developed. Now, that lasted about 12,000 years, a little less, and probably would have gone on for many thousands of years more, or even, millions of years possibly. But as humans industrialized, and we began to, producing all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, testing nuclear weapons, producing synthetic compounds in corporate labs, all of this started affecting the composition not only of the atmosphere but also of the rocks of. And one example I use in the book to demonstrate what the Anthropocene means is that of a half-billion-year-old fossils of trilobites that were part of an ancient sea in the desert of what is now Utah. And when scientists studied these fossils recently, looking for their chemical composition, they were trying to figure out what kind of environments that I lived in half a billion years ago, looking for, you know, chemical markers that would tell us something about the plants, the microorganisms that were there at the time. But instead, what they found is about half of the chemical markers of these fossils were made from synthetic chemicals that were produced in our labs. And that's a real fundamental change to the stratigraphy of the Earth. That's a symptom of what we're calling the Anthropocene. And roughly, the people who are dedicated to studying this are dating it at somewhere around the 1950s and early 60s as the end of the Holocene and the beginning of the Anthropocene. Now, that same word has taken a bit of a life of its own, in which it's taken on more sociopolitical implications. And I think there's some very valid uses as a communication tool to the other uses of the Anthropocene. But when I was writing the book, I was thinking strictly about the scientific definition of it.
So what's the implications of this new era that we are in?
So the way I think of it is that it's a sign that humans have changed the world irrevocably. I mean, the world's it's a different planet than the one I was born in the, you know, mid-1960s. It's just, and there's no going back to it. However, the future holds a range of possibilities. Even with all the irrevocable changes, we can still steer towards a much more benign aspect of that range. And in order to do so, we need to change the story that we tell ourselves of what humans are, of what industrial society can be, so that we can steer towards the better part of that range. And that is the fundamental premise of the book.
Okay, so let's explore that a little bit further, because people have a lot of concerns of what we're doing to nature, to the planet, how we've industrialized, how we've polluted, how we're altering the climate. So there's so much fear about the future. What are your thoughts from what you've been doing?
Well, I think those fears are legitimate, but we need to turn them into something more constructive. We need to turn them into actions that move us towards the better part of that range. So if we continue business as usual, you know, burning fossil fuels the way we have, increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, exploiting forest, fish populations the way we have, we're not going to end up in a very, very good part of that range. But if we decide, okay, we have an ethical responsibility not only to all humans, particularly the poor who are hit hardest by, you know, climate change, but also to our non-human relatives, and we're going to take this seriously, and we start changing, you know, the values we bring into resource management, in which we start focusing on managing ourselves so that we focus on what we leave out there, how much fish we leave out there, how many forests we choose to leave standing so that they can support other life forms and, you know, absorb CO2 and so forth. I think we are very much in time towards have a pretty decent future. We don't have much time to make that move. We need to get out of the business as usual path fairly quickly. I mean, certainly within the less than 10 years. But if we awaken to what really matters, I think we can do this.
I interviewed a very interesting author and farmer from Australia. His name is Charles Massey. I don't know if you ever heard of him. But he is... he's someone that travels around the world because his message is talking about regenerative agriculture. So you're working with indigenous people, looking at the fish populations and the management of the forests there. So he's working with farmers he first started in Australia and now travels around the world. And he really inspired me because his message is very similar to yours. You know, we're on a trajectory and we have some important choices to make really quickly. And so he has developed regenerative agriculture, which allows people who've been on land that's been depleted, that's been over-farmed, that's been basically devoid of nutrients, and this is especially true in Australia, in the farming practices in Australia. And he teaches people how to totally regenerate the land, and he started with his own farm. And in my conversation with him, he talks about how his land has changed. And, you know, because he works with more indigenous species, and doesn't till the soil, and he works with the topography, and he brings in these animals that had basically disappeared off that landscape, and they're returning, and the insects and the predators. And as a result, he said he doesn't get any grasshopper invasions anymore because he has this environmental, you know, balance with all the facets of the environment. And that, you know, that was so inspiring for me to know how quickly nature can regenerate if we allow it, if we support that process to bring this life and this fertility back to the land in all ways. And I'm sure that's part of what you are working with.
Yeah. No, that is a great example that you just gave us. And, you know, and this, those agricultural practices as well are really important for taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and putting it back into the soils, as opposed to industrial agricultural practices that tend to release more carbon dioxide out of the soil and into the atmosphere. So that is another example of you know, what is going on in different parts of the world that I think can gives us signs of optimism.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, there's a possibility that we can revive soils or resources that we have depleted so seriously. But nature is incredible in the ability to regenerate. Can you, you know, you've done so many interesting things working with indigenous cultures. Can you give us some stories that bring us greater inspiration about what's happening now? It's really easy, Alejandro, don't you think, to get depressed, to feel like, oh, we've messed things up so badly, that's the end of the world, and, you know, we have to pay the price. But there's another story unfolding. And I was wondering if you can give us some, from your experience, some inspirational insights out of your work with indigenous peoples.
So there's one example about a Dungeness crab that I think illustrates, you know, aspects of how things can change relatively rapid. And the story, even though it's about Dungeness crab, it's much bigger than that. So Dungeness crab are a very important traditional food to the four First Nations that I work with. You know, they're served at their potlatches, which are really important feasts in which, you know, that have a governance function as well as a ceremonial function. They're really cherished. And you know, up until the late 1990s, there was enough Dungeness crab around for them to meet their traditional foods. But then commercial fisheries started coming in for crab, recreational fisheries expanded, and there was a big decline in Dungeness crab, and they were having a hard time getting enough for their traditional practices. And they went to the federal government and said, hey, we got a problem here. And the federal government said, well, we don't think so. We're managing things well. And, you know, and that led to a series of, you know, bad interactions. And then we did some experimental research to show that there was an impact from the fisheries. And we did a formally interviewed people to document how they've been their catches had been declining, and eventually this led to a change of discourse with the federal government. In essence, a couple of years ago, the federal government said, "Okay, sorry, we haven't been doing a good job of listening to you. And we're going to work together with you." And we started collaborating with the federal government on the science and management of Dungeness crab. And this has led to legislated closures for commercial fisheries in the areas that the First Nations were most concerned about. Now, if you look at the history of really racist policies that have led up to, you know, this more recent period of time, that shift in dialogue is huge. I mean, it happened within probably 10 years, which doesn't sound like a short time, but in the bigger picture, it is a short time. I mean, within 10 years, we went from people being combative to people say starting to work together on what could be viewed as a common problem, and this is a change in accepting different ways of knowing, accepting for scientists to accept that the traditional knowledge had a lot of value. And also different legal systems. The indigenous people were saying under our traditional laws, there should be no harvest of these species in these places because they're overfished. And that is what ended up being legislated in more Western forms of law.
Well, that's a positive story for sure, especially to know that the federal government is responsive to what the needs are, and they're willing to stop commercial fishing. That's huge.
It is huge. It's very recent, but the trend is expanding. Recently, there was a very important piece of legislation that that was amended so that explicitly states that indigenous knowledge has to be taken into account when making decisions for fishery management. It's a recent change, so we have to be a little skeptical as to how it gets implemented. But the fact that the legal language is changing opens up possibilities. And just to remind you of the context, I mean, in only 40 years ago or so, it was illegal for a lot of the traditional indigenous practices to take place. It's not very long ago that the era of residential schools ended, and things are now shifting towards resurgence of political influence and recognition of knowledge in favor of First Nations.
That's certainly good news, because those cultures are just so important for us. They're like national treasures, as far as I'm concerned. The wisdom that is held by those indigenous cultures all over the world. I mean, I spend some time in Costa Rica with some of the indigenous cultures there, and I've had time with indigenous cultures in Australia, Native American cultures, and I just have such respect for the wisdom found within those cultures, because they have such a strong bond with their land and understanding the powers of healing from connecting to the land. Because you've worked so much with these nations, can you share with us some of what you have learned from them about how to view the world, how to be in the world, how to walk in the world?
I think the most important thing I take from my experience is how the notion that we have non-human relatives out there that we are responsible for, that we have reciprocity towards and gratitude, that notion is so prevalent to the culture. And, you know, when a biologist says other species are our relatives, what that biologist really means is we're genetically related. When in an indigenous culture, when they say those other species are our relatives, they really mean that, you know, we are responsible for them, and they nourish us, and we must act with reciprocity towards them. It's a fundamentally different way of approaching the world, and I think this is something that needs to infiltrate the larger collective psyche of our civilization that would make all the difference. The notion of taking only what we need is so prevalent. And I'll tell you a brief story. I was out on a very small boat with an elder called Charlie Mason. He was in his early 70s at the time. And we're picking up a halibut line. So it's about a kilometer of line set at the bottom with a couple hundred hooks. And in this very small open boat, there's no mechanical hauler. So I started just pulling up by hand, and Charlie goes, hey, move over, young man. It's my turn. I'm like, Charlie, I'm a little younger than you. Just let me keep pulling up the line. He's like, no. I may be a very important hereditary chief, but I'm not a king. So move over, young man. I'm going to do my part. And then, which I thought by itself was a real statement about the character of Charlie. But then afterwards, he tells me, an uncle of mine taught me quite a few years back that if we make this infusion out of this forest plant, this plant from the rainforest, and soak the fishing gear in it, it brings up our catch rate quite a bit. And last time I used it, I out of 200 hooks, we got up like 120 halibut, and which is more than double what we had gotten that day. And I say, well, Charlie, so how come we're not doing that right now? And he's like, well, we would get a lot more than what we need. We don't need 120 halibut right now. We just want 50 for the upcoming feast. And that notion of taking only what you need is just pervades the whole everyday life of these people. It comes over and up, over and over again.
Wow, that's a beautiful story of really understanding. To understand that, you really have to have a totally different wiring of your brain, right? Because we in our Western culture always are wanting to grasp for more. We're always wanting more, and it's the cultural programming. It's whatever you want to call it, the ego or this perception that there's there's unlimited amounts, and we want our share of it as much as we can get, whether we need it or not. But it's very different programming for Native American culture, very different way of seeing the world.
It is a different programming, but it's not something that's wired into our brain. I mean, there's nothing biological in our system that says humans must be a geologic force, or Western cultures must be a geologic force that changes the planet and that overfishes. It's really a matter of it's really more about ethics and philosophy. It's not about something ingrained in any particular type of human. We can all learn, or basically unlearn the destructive parts of our culture and unlearn better ways of relating to our planet and our non-human relatives.
And it's very much connected to the spiritual awareness. And, one of the great ahas that I have had in the last few years that I've been working with more Indigenous people, Indigenous medicine, Indigenous healing, is that our culture has so insulated us from nature. We live 95% of our time indoors. We have rubber soles on our shoes, so we no longer have a connection. We're insulated from the magnetic field of the planet. We put sunscreen on, so we don't get any of the wavelengths and information that the sun is giving us, and our food has become so synthetic, our clothing. And Native cultures live very differently because they live so close to the land and so close to nature and so connected to nature. And I think that's been one of the big aha moments is for me is that we are part of this web of life. And when we live back in balance again with nature, we find more of our spirit or our soul. There's a transformation that happens. And that brings us a much greater sense of joy and fulfillment than when we're, you know, living our Western values. So I just treasure these cultures so much because they're teaching us to find ourselves.
Yes, that's right. And but you know, it's also interesting and important to note how these cultures are very much part of our modern world as well. So in being part of the modern world, just to round out the picture, they do some things that contribute to our modern problems, but they're problems that they did not create. They're problems that were basically imported, that were brought from elsewhere, and in some way, they were forced to assimilate. And some individuals and some decisions that they make are not the best. But what really is fundamental is that cultural ethos that we've been talking about, in which we have obligations to the rest of biodiversity. And that's where the integration of science and indigenous knowledge is important in terms of differences and complementarity. In a scientific inquiry, the method is trying to not bring any values any values into how you try to answer the questions. But the values do come into the questions you ask. So indigenous knowledge can really inform what those questions being asked are. And in looking at the broader set of relationships and responsibilities, a scientist ends up asking different questions than he or she would otherwise.
How do you think working with in your job and working with those indigenous communities has changed you?
Well, it's given me a tremendous sense of optimism that I didn't have before. It's making me appreciate the resilience of the human spirit. How people who have suffered so much trauma from a historical context are able to stand up again and bring back some really important values that were put to sleep in the past, and the fact that they were able to live sustainably for so many centuries prior to European colonization it's made me rethink what the essence of being human is. And humans are not inherently destructive. There's nothing in our genetic makeup that tells us that we have to be. We can develop social institutions like the hereditary chief system being one of them, but in a traditional context, but that can sort of become integrated into modern ways of thinking makes us a lot more responsible for our actions in terms of how we affect our non-human relatives.
So from your work and from writing your book, Changing Tides, which I really, really encourage people to read, you just get more into your heart when you read your book, Alejandro. You've done such a good job. What would your advice be to people? What are the steps they could do to support this positive change to reconnect back to nature, reconnecting back to themselves, being part of a movement that brings back more balance and harmony in how we deal with nature. What are the things you are wanting people to know, and what are some of the practical things you can offer people?
Yeah, so on a more philosophical level, to pursue a practice that connects you to nature is really fundamental, because it removes the abstraction of what a biodiversity crisis is, what a climate change crisis is. In getting yourself, wet and dirty in the forest and, going after learning about plants or birds, it really commits you to connecting with what really matters and then protecting it. In my case, I'll do a lot of diving for our research surveys, and you're literally immersed in the pulsing living aspects of the ecosystem. And I know that has really committed me to working harder towards protecting those ecosystems. Most places, certainly in the Americas, have a history of indigenous cultures, and becoming aware of those histories and learning about the cultures that are still there and what their traditional laws are, and engaging in conversations with those cultures is a really good step towards rethinking our connection to nature. In a more sort of pragmatic way, the book is not really about that. I mean, there's plenty of other books for that, but just anything that gets you to, be a less consumptive, to a less consumptive lifestyle, and real basic things like eating less meat, that goes a long way. And any kind of political activism that you can get involved in so that we move away from a fossil fuel-driven economy to one that doesn't, that it's not built on burning more fossil fuels is really quite essential. I want people to, read the book, feel themselves connect to these places, to the cultures that I describe, and finish the book and say, okay, I got a positive surge of energy that's going to, lead me to some activism. I'm going to go vote in favor of this candidate that, wants to, transition away from our fossil fuel economy.
Was this the impulse that got you to write this book? This is your second book, but I'm just wondering what it was that inspired you to write this.
The real impulse for this one is to get away, people away from the notion that humans are inherently destructive. I mean, we talked a little bit about that already, but just realizing that there's an alternative, plausible story of what humans can be. And in my experience, many elements of that alternative story are in the history of the indigenous people I work with, but not only the past history, but the modern aspects of what they're doing now. The whole set of relationships of reciprocity and gratitude towards living things, it's what needs to pervade our broader ways of thinking. And I think trying to get people to connect to those ideas was my main impetus for writing the book.
Well, I think you did a really good job at doing that. Is there anything, as we're kind of coming to the end of this conversation, is there anything else, Alejandra, that you want to share or speak to before we bring this conversation to a conclusion?
I want to emphasize the tremendous generosity of the people I've worked with. Once they sense that you're going into their communities with an open heart, ready to learn, ready to collaborate, they've just been treated me like family, and And that has been incredibly satisfying. I've met especially a lot of elder women who tell me stories of their upbringing that I find really inspiring. And they're so involved in the revitalizing of their culture. There's a woman from the village of Wikino. Her traditional name is Kanilkas, and her English name is Alvina Johnson. And she tells me how she goes down to the river in the spring to sing to the river so that uligan, which are a very species of fish that go and spawn in the river, can come back and spawn again. And whenever someone like that shares a story like that, it just, really warms my heart and gives me added energy to do what I do.
I would think so. You know, it's like it's realizing what a blessing it is to be part of this culture and to be accepted and to learn from it. So, you're very blessed, Alejandro.
Yes, I am.
So if people want to pick up a copy of Changing Tides, where should they go?
So the book is available through the publisher, which is New Society Publishers. That's probably the preferred way to go. But if another option is certainly available through Amazon. I know quite a few bookstores in different parts of the states are carrying it. If you are going to order it, look at the New Society Publishers website. You should be able to get it there.
Okay, New Society Publishers. And if they want to know more about you, you have a website as well. Can you share that with us?
Yes. So the website is my name, Alejandro Freed Ecology at Weebly.com. If I'm giving you the wrong name, just Google my name, and it's probably the first thing that comes up. Sorry, I have a bad memory for what URLs.
So, and I want everyone to know that your surname Freed is F-R-I-D. So if they want to find you, it's Alejandro Freed. And Alejandro, it's just been an absolute pleasure having you as a guest on my show today. I wish you the greatest success with not only your book, Changing Tides, but the wonderful work that you're doing. So I just truly wish you the greatest success.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. And to all my listeners, thank you for joining me once again on The Love Code. I know you'll be returning again next week, every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. But remember, if you just go to my Facebook page, What Women Must Know, or opt in to drdrcherylselman.com, this show and the other show that I do on this network, What Women Must Know, will also be coming your way. So until next time, may your week be filled with love, peace, and harmony. Bye for now.